And you're tuned into CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. This is CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Thanks for tuning in. We are now going to shift gears towards a discussion, actually a roundtable here at the CKUT studios. It's building off an online roundtable that has been happening called Beyond Stop Harbor. That is a discussion that the Media Co-op, which is a coast-to-coast independent media project, has been facilitating over the past month. And this discussion is looking at the challenges that social justice movements face in challenging the austerity measures being imposed by the Conservative government in Canada. And joining us in studio to talk about this roundtable and some of the ideas that have been coming up is Pascal Burnett, who is a local artist and activist, and Jeremy Bidaldvin, who is a syndicalist. He was a spokesperson for the Association pour une solidarité syndicale étudiante, ASSE, the Quebec Student Federation that was very active during the strike of 2012, and Drew Ojaje, who is an editor at Media Co-op and also a social activist over the past decade, who has been involved in various issues. Good day to everybody.
Hello.
Hey.
Well, first of all, I'd just like to thank you all for coming. And in terms of our discussion, the title is Beyond Stop Harbor. I'll throw out a general question to you all, which is, what are you think some of the greatest challenges that the grassroots left faces in terms of dealing with the Conservative government and austerity measures? Austerity is a huge topic, but we can see cuts being imposed on a variety of levels and altercations towards public funding being imposed, whether it's the funding of the public healthcare system or, of course, cuts to universities and cégeps here in Quebec. Austerity has also been adopted locally under the Parti Québécois with their zero deficit obsession. So I'm wondering from you all, in this context, what do you feel are some of the major challenges the grassroots left faces in dealing with austerity?
I think one of the main things, or I guess there are two main things that come to mind. One is when you're sort of dealing with this sort of systematic assault that we're calling austerity, I think a big problem is name recognition, getting people, sort of at the grassroots level, but beyond sort of the activist milieu to identify and name that problem as austerity. I think that's where really the media, which tends to find all kinds of different ways to divide us and distract us, really plays a major role. You have the big debate over the chart happening in Quebec right now, which I think is a classic example of a really great way to distract people. In the rest of Canada, you have basically all three parties have sort of tacitly agreed not to name the problem, and even the leftmost party, the NDP, has said explicitly that it will not raise taxes on the economic elite. So you have a massive transfer of wealth happening, basically from the poorest or the lowest income parts of the population to the richest, and so that needs to be identified as such. But that's not necessarily happening. I'll leave it at that. Maybe other people have something to say.
I think that one of the main challenges the grassroots left faces right now is actually not necessarily facing Harper, but facing the institutional left, facing unions, facing organized community groups, and facing political parties. And that's an old challenge of the grassroots left, one it has seldom managed to deal with. What we are seeing right now are very interesting developments in the grassroots movements. We are seeing Idle No More, that recently, just yesterday, I think, did an inspiring action, which was very violently repressed here in Quebec. We are seeing students take to the streets you know, they've done so last year, they will do so this year, as they have done so in 40 years of history in Quebec and even in the rest of Canada. We are seeing amazing environmental activism, very courageous people doing direct action, disrupting meetings and so on. And at the same time, we are seeing the institutional left being struggling to articulate the response that they should, a response to the challenges, the attacks of the Stephen Harper's government and his austerity measures, or the PQ austerity measures. You've mentioned that the NDP is not even willing to raise taxes on the very rich, which is something even a third wave, Social Democratic Party should be able to consider. We are also seeing what I see as a failure of labor unions to protect their workers, and that's even a failure to protect their own organizations, as the conservative government has pushed Bill C-377, which aims to disclose, force unions to disclose spendings of more than $5,000, a clear attack on unions. Bill C-525, a private member's bill, which could lead to decertifications in the public sector. Where are unions opposing these measures? They struggle to deal with even their own survival, to protect their own survival, and at the same time, how could we expect them to deal with broader social issues? There are several movements still that are encouraging happening right now, and I will talk about them later, I suppose.
I think that another way that austerity has been affecting us is to take away our ability to connect with each other, because a lot of like social program that actually create spaces where people can come and gather and create social links are being cut. So there's less and less collective space where we can come and mingle and actually name things like austerity. And I feel that for a lot of people, capitalism have kind of eaten our brain and creates this idea of scarcity, that like things like people who are asking for social justice are actually just pulling resources away from the collective, when actually it's the opposite that's happening. Like really rich people are taking the work of middle class and poor to become richer and richer and richer, but they manage to do it in a way that in our collective imagination we have this idea that like social movement are always asking for more, that and that more thing doesn't happen, instead of seeing it as a space where we actually create links in between each other to provide us from falling into the cracks of the system. Drew, you mentioned that the charter is a distraction, but I also feel that it's also an opportunity to address some issues. And like I've been seeing more people talking about like identity and nationalism, and it's also creating a space to address issue around colonization, which is something that we have a lot of problem to do. And I feel that like the conservative and the right wing are, you know, they did some pretty fucked up declaration in the press about how Canada doesn't have a colonial past. In 2010, during the No Olympic on Stolen Land campaign, they were saying stuff like that. And I feel that's an underlying, you know, issue that we have a problem as the institutional left and leftists in general to address.
Well, thank you all for your thoughts. One of the key points of the economic action plan, as the conservatives have called it, is their pipelines and the massive development of things like the tar sands and the construction of coast-to-coast pipelines to transport tar sands oil, which, of course, has been largely contested by First Nations communities in the area where the tar sands are being developed at such a massive scale. Beyond northern Alberta, of course, here in Quebec, we had the protests that took place against Plan North, and the voice of opposition to that development plan, and really the resource-driven economic model, which is very short-term in a lot of ways, was also strongly opposed by Indigenous communities in northern Quebec. So in terms of understanding the basis of the conservative economic vision for Canada. How central is looking at that from the perspective, as Pascal was talking about, as a perspective rooted in looking at today's economics in relation to that colonial relationship to First Nations people? How important is that vision also in terms of a broader effort to challenge the Conservatives?
I think that that what the sort of decolonization discussion does, and what the fact that First Nations Indigenous people have so much leverage legally in Canada relative to anyone else in terms of stopping these kinds of developments does, is that it forces us to reach sort of all the way down to the bottom of our history and of the lived experience of what it means to live in Canada today. You know, I think a lot of social movements in the past have sort of papered over various aspects. And I think that what having to talk about colonization does is it forces us to talk about sort of the fundamental foundations of Canadian history, which is, you know, on a continuing basis, the theft of Indigenous land. And the use of that wealth, you know, to enrich, you know, theoretically everyone. And then we can, once we talk about, okay, that wealth is being stolen, then we can talk about, okay, how is it being distributed? Is it being distributed to a tiny elite, or is it being sort of redistributed through a welfare state? And these debates and struggles have happened through history. But I think this is maybe, I hesitate to say the first time, but certainly, one of the sort of major opportunities that we've had, I think, to really have that discussion beyond a sort of small circles of Native people struggling for their rights, but to make that discussion mainstream and to really sort of reformulate what it means to live, you know, on land in Canada that's been stolen.
Yeah, I think it's also a discussion to bring, you know, in our organization and group, but also to bring back home. I think that decolonization is really important also to understand it, like in what happened to Indigenous families, like to what is this transgenerational violence that is getting reproduced years after years after years, generation after generation. And I think that right now with the Idle No More movement, but also with things that happened in the past, we're seeing like a massive group of people who are asking for healing, but also radical transformation of the colonial relationship that non-Indigenous people have been entertaining with Indigenous communities. And I think that's also a difficult discussion to have, like, in our private house. You know, what does it to mean to be to have settler privilege? Where does that come from? How does it impact the way we interact with each other? And they're really uncomfortable conversation to have. Previously, I mentioned the charter, but, like, especially in my family, it's been, like, a huge opportunity to have uncomfortable discussion about, you know, when people were saying with, like, migrant people just... you know, they should be doing what we're doing. And I would kind of open a door about, like, well, what are we doing with Indigenous communities? Which, you know, kind of are uncomfortable conversation to have often. But I feel they're really necessary. A couple of months ago, there was the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, and I've attended a panel which was named Femmes de Courage, who was organized by Femmes Autochtones du Québec. And one of the main things they were talking about was the need of healing inside the communities and inside the families, that the private and intimate space is completely interacting with the bigger space. So, yeah, I think that's another really interesting space where we can bring decolonization.
Jeremy?
Well, it's a lot of work that we will be facing. I mean, I've had the same conversations, and so far I've been lucky enough so that they wouldn't be so uncomfortable. I've been struck by a very open family, but you know, it's something we still have to face our own privileges day to day. And around the Idle No More movements, I've noticed a very interesting section of the Quebec left say, oh, you know, this is the fault of Canadian oppressors. This is the fault of English Canadian oppressors, completely denying French Canadians' own responsibility in bringing in this historical and present violence against Indigenous peoples.
Mm-hmm.
I would just add that, I mean, I think we need to see the pipelines as a major sort of national project on the sort of on the scale of the sort of the railroad, building the railroad, for example. I mean, it really just opens the door to a whole new level of exploitation of the tar sands. And basically what they're talking about is going from, you know, 1 to 2 million barrels a day of production to like, you know, to five million barrels a day and up of production. So when we talk about pipelines, that's what we're talking about is making, you know, what Neil Young called, you know, he compared it to Hiroshima.
The area of the tar sands.
The area of the tar sands. And then, you know, take that times five. That's what they're trying to do right now.
You're tuned into CKUT 90.3 FM. This is Off the Hour, our community news program. This is a panel discussion called Beyond Stop Harper. We're in studio with Drew Ojaje, who is a writer and one of the editors at Media Co-op, and Jelmy Bidalvin, who is an activist, a unionist, and has been very involved in the ASSE Student Federation, and Pascal Burnett, who is an artist and activist in Montreal. I wanted to bring up a point now. We only have about 8 minutes remaining in this discussion, down to some specifics about austerity. Recently, ASSE launched a website, austerite.org, which details some numbers about what austerity means. So, Jeremy, maybe we could hear from you a bit about what is on that campaign website of the ASSE, the Student Federation. But in regards to furthering that discussion, Drew and Pascal, I'd be interested in hearing from you how you feel austerity, because this is a term we hear a lot in the media. How does that actually affect people's lives? How does that translate to social violence on a day-to-day basis? I'll start, Jeremy.
Absolutely. Yes, this website was launched a few weeks ago, along with a campaign against austerity. And hopefully it will be available in English at some point. I know they're working hard on a translation. And I know Benjamin, our spokesperson, will be on the air of CKUT tomorrow to talk about it in more detail. I think the point of this austerity campaign is to work to take the long road and take an intersectorial vision of social struggles, to be able to go beyond, as a student union, to go beyond strictly educational issues, higher education issues. We've been talking about tuition fees for 5 years now. It was the subject of a very broad social movement. We realized then that our action could go much further than simply opposing this tuition increase, and we decided to do it against a backdrop of austerity. The main challenge we will be facing in 2015 is to be able to go beyond simply stopping Harper, beyond voting for the NDP or voting in a new government. We have to oppose ideas, and we have to oppose this very powerful narrative of austerity that all governments at all levels share in both Quebec and Canada. And that was the point of the campaign, I think. And that's maybe to finish on a more hopeful note, because I did say earlier that Labour had trouble articulating a different vision. I think maybe taking inspiration from this campaign, Labour and social movements can articulate a platform of unity ahead of these elections and beyond those elections to be able to move forward. I think there are very interesting projects happening right now. First of all, the birth of UNIFOR a few weeks ago, which will bring in a fresh vision of social unionism in Canada, as well as several initiatives underway to help promote common platforms and common action across borders, both physical borders, but also cultural borders. A social forum in Canada, First Nations, Quebec, happening next year. And I think we'll be seeing a lot of movement along those lines ahead of the election. And I think this is a very good sign that Labour is seeing that it must go beyond its corporatist reflexes, beyond simply protecting their own workers sector by sector, and must take a wider perspective. And I think that's very good news for the left in Canada.
I feel that in general, one of the way austerity operates, it's the idea like that we only see really short-term things. It's like we really need to keep the economy rolling. We don't know exactly where it's going, but it's going to get bigger and it's going to be awesome. When we actually live in a world that, you know, there trees will die at one point and there will be new trees if we take care of the earth. And, you know, it's a long-term thing. But austerity operates in a way that we're cutting social program, being like, oh, we don't have any more money for this housing project, so we're just going to cut it without thinking about what's going to happen to the people who were living from those subventions. Are they going to go in the streets? You know, are they going to get sick because they're really, really anxious and they don't know where they're going to live or nor what they're going to eat? So I feel that it's hard sometimes for people to know like exactly what's happening right now, because it might just gonna have a consequence in 2, 4, 5, or 10 years in their life, like the change we're seeing with l'assurance chômage and stuff like that. You know, maybe you're not unemployed right now, but you're gonna become in 10 years, and in 10 years the program will be completely different. But you know, and it's I feel that the way that it's happening, it's we're actually isolated from one another in those struggle, and it's really difficult to connect all the dots and be like, oh wow, it's happening everywhere at the same time. And it's often feel, especially for people who, you know, might just start learning about those kind of politics, really scary to be like, oh, there's just too much work to do, so you know, maybe I should just continue to work and, you know, keep my business on. But I feel that's one of the way austerity affect people.
Drew, final comments?
Yeah, I think when you look at austerity, exactly as Pascal was saying, there's it's really easy to sort of isolate all the different experiences. And I think the real challenge that the left has is to connect the lived experience of all those little things, whether it's a little harder to get, you know, social housing, or a lot harder, or your public service union is under attack, you know, or your welfare rates aren't keeping pace with inflation. I think we need to like somehow find ways of connecting all those lived experiences to an analysis to and name the problem as this political idea and attack that political idea, as Jeremy was saying. And I think that Assay has probably done the best job, which is you know, in some ways really discouraging, in the sense that, you know, they're probably one of the organizations with the least resources among left-wing groups, you know, I won't call them the institutionalized left, but among the left forces that have groupings that have resources, you know, they probably have the least resources. And the fact that they're on the cutting edge of this really just shows how far we have to come, and how we really need to, you know, change the culture and change the whole, you know, we want to talk about changing economic relations in society more broadly. I think we first have to start talking about changing the way, you know, changing relations to ideas, to each other on the left, and start rebuilding those things so that we have a strong foundation, and we can actually start to imagine how we might connect people's daily lives to these ideas, which we, you know, the idea of austerity and the idea of what's wrong with the world, what we need to attack, and on the other hand, the idea of what the alternative might be, what we can build towards, and we haven't, I don't think the left has really done that in a really long time, so we need to start where we are.
Well, thank you all for your thoughts, speaking of a lot of challenges, but also some very inspiring campaigns that are happening here in Quebec and coast to coast. We've been speaking with Drew Ojaje, who is a writer and an editor at the Media Co-op, Jeremy Bidalbvin, who is a syndicalist, a unionist, and has been very involved in the Assay Student Federation, and Pascal Burnett, who is an artist and community organizer in Montreal. This is all a discussion that is building off an online forum that has been launched at the Media Cooperative website called Beyond Stop Harper. You can add your voice and commentary to that project by visiting Media Co-op. mediacoop.ca/beyondstopharper. That's mediacoop.ca/beyondstopharper. Thank you for listening to this segment on Off the Hour. I've been your host, Stefan Christoph.